This is VOA News. I'm Philip Alexiou. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday the United States is willing to hold unconditional talks with Iran to ease tensions between the two countries. Pompeo says we're prepared to engage in a conversation with no preconditions. We're ready to sit down with them.
We're ready to sit down with them. But the American effort to fundamentally reverse the malign activity of this Islamic Republic, this revolutionary force, is going to continue.
Tehran has little hope for new negotiations. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said in an interview on the ABC News network that new talks with Washington are not very likely. President Donald Trump said Sunday that America has had enough with Mexico. On Twitter, Trump saying that either they stop the invasion of our country by drug dealers and cartels and human traffickers and coyotes and illegal immigrants, which they can very easily do, or many companies and jobs that have been foolishly allowed to move south of the border will be brought back to the United States through taxation. On Fox News Sunday, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney says there are a couple of steps the Mexican government can take, starting with securing its southern border with Guatemala to block Central American migrants from crossing into the U.S.
Most of the people who are coming in through Mexico now are not Mexico, not Mexicans. They are from Guatemala and El Salvador, other countries south of Mexico. That border is only a quarter as long as the border with the United States.
Meanwhile, President Trump is threatening to impose a 5% tariff on Mexican exports sent to the U.S., doing so unless it blocks the migrants short of the U.S. border. This is VOA News. The U.S. State Department will now require almost all applicants for U.S. visas to submit social media, email, and telephone information, meaning those applying for immigrant and non-immigrant visas will have to list all social media usernames and email addresses and telephone numbers used in the past 5 years. The requirements affect 15 million foreigners. Only applicants for diplomatic and official visas could be exempt from the new rules. Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan is on his Asian trip now, and while there, he's already made it clear that China is his number one concern. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more from Singapore.
Speaking to an audience at the annual Shangri-La Defense Forum, Shanahan said the U.S. would not ignore Chinese behavior, which he says has threatened prosperity in the region. And China has continued to project more military power beyond its borders, most notably by constructing artificial islands in the South China Sea and placing heavy weapons on them to support territorial claims not recognized under international law.
They argue that it's defensive. It looks like it's a bit overkill.
Recently, the U.S. has pushed for more international patrols in the South China Sea, including one last month with Japan, India, and the Philippines. Carla Babb, VOA News, Singapore.
Well, the Pentagon has told the White House to keep the military out of politics after someone from the White House directed the Navy to keep the warship USS John McCain, quote, out of sight when President Donald Trump visited Japan. So, while on his way to Seoul, Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan addressed the issue with reporters.
The White House military office gave a directive that the USS John McCain should be hidden from view. The directive was not carried out.
U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad visited Pakistan Sunday at the beginning of his 16-day multi-nation trip that'll also take him to Qatar for another round of peace negotiations with the Taliban. Officials said Khalilzad held delegation-level talks at the foreign ministry before meeting with other senior Pakistani civilian and military leaders during his day-long stay in Islamabad. The Pakistani government takes credit for arranging the U.S.-Taliban peace dialogue by using its contacts with the Afghan insurgent group. Well, a cruise ship lost control as it docked in Venice on Sunday, crashing into the wharf and hitting a tourist boat after suffering an engine failure. Tourists on land could be seen running away from the 13-deck opera. I'm Philip Alexiou, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Burundi, when it wanted to join SADC, it was to some extent hiding or fleeing the East African community because it have been identified as a threat to the East African community.
The Southern African Development Community, or SADC, reject Burundi's membership application.
Instead of trying to see what they can do, they tell you that Cameroon is a sovereign state and they do not believe in another country coming to interfere. But they forget that Cameroon is part of a living world and problems in Cameroon affect other countries of the world.
The Cameroonian government accuses NGOs of over-exaggeration of the ongoing crisis.
So the house is built on extremely durable water tanks, 18 cubic meters, who collects all the water during the rainy season and then gives enough water in order to grow the vegetables and the fruits that they need during the year.
And Africa's population is expected to more than double by 2050. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Burundian civil society groups have hailed the decision by the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, to reject the country's application to join the regional bloc. Namibian President Haige Geingob said in a statement that Burundi did not meet the requirement needed to be accepted as a member of the organization. For more reaction from the Burundian civil society groups, I reached Vital Nshimirimana, the Burundian leader of the group for the strengthening of civil society.
The SADC decision rejecting Burundi application to the community is a very right and a due decision. And it was taken in our satisfaction because the government of Burundi does not deserve to enter any other community because it is doing very wrong things.
SADC said the reason why it rejected the application of Burundi is because the country remains politically unstable. However, the Burundian administration says the country remains stable and that you are part to blame for creating the impression that the country remains unstable.
Yeah, well, some countries of SADC, including South Africa, have played tremendous role in the signing of the Arusha Peace Agreement and have been following the situation of Burundi for years. And they are very well informed about the situation in Burundi and have clearly identified the source of the crisis now in Burundi, being the president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, seeking to remain in power unconstitutionally. Second, the crisis in Burundi have forced thousands of Burundians in exile. Some are in Tanzania and in the region. Tanzania is a member of SADC, they know. Another thing is there are failed Burundian dialogue which have been followed by many. And all the international community is informed that there is ongoing crisis which remains unsolved.
But the government has always insisted that it never violated the Arusha Accord. Burundians went to the polls to overwhelmingly vote for President Pierre Nkurunziza. Not only that, they amended the constitution to enable him to stand for re-election, and he won legitimately. Why are you kicking against this?
No. All what is done in Burundi is done against the terror, which is performed by the Burundian militia in Mbonerakure, worth of about 100,000 youths, which were recruited forcibly and which are utilized to terrorize, to intimidate all the dissident voices. And in a situation where there is no free press, no free speech, where there is no free political space, we cannot think that one can amend the Constitution. The amendment of the Constitution was a false amendment which does not lie other categories of the community.
Officials of SADC are saying they are continuously monitoring the situation in Burundi. But do you anticipate that Burundi could meet that threshold of political stability to be accepted into the regional bloc SADC?
Well, what the SADC is doing, it is informed by many indicators, including the East African community, where Burundi joined some 10 years ago. And Burundi, when it wanted to join SADC, it was to some extent hiding or fleeing the East African community because it have been identified as a threat to the East African community. And all these informations, the SADC, they are very well informed about that.
Vital Nshimirimana is the Burundian leader of the Group for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He spoke with me from Brussels. The leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF, says it is regrettable that the government accused human rights and non-governmental organizations of exaggerating the effects of the ongoing crisis. John Fruindi also says the international community should pressure President Paul Biya's government to resolve the crisis. His remarks came after Foreign Relations Minister Lucien Mbela accused NGOs of embellishing political turmoil in the English-speaking regions. For more, I reach the main Cameroonian opposition leader, John Fruindi.
The government of Cameroon is fond of making falsified statements. Cameroon is not somebody's private entity that is hiding in his pocket. We are part of the living world. And with the gadgets that we have out today, people, citizens of other countries are seeing what is happening in Cameroon and they're filming and giving to their own people. So the government of Cameroon cannot hide the wanton destruction, the killings, the maiming, carrying out on the Cameroonian people again any longer because they will not go unnoticed.
Recently, you had the Prime Minister coming to part of the Anglophone regions. He met you and other elders in the region. Have you gotten any feedback following the meeting about finding ways to resolve this crisis?
Well, the Prime Minister came on a talk, and spoken and gone. It's the same thing that former Prime Minister Philemon Yang came here, sat down with the teachers and the lawyers, and they discussed and agreed on points to be put down and what was supposed to be done. He never did this, and they started arresting the leaders of these consortiums of the teachers and the lawyers' union. So with all those arrests that they made, after discussing with the people, nothing was done. Now they are still coming to talk. I think they want just to keep people talking while Mr. Biya is aging and going. And the talk would mean nothing because they are not able to do anything at all.
So what is the current situation in the country, particularly in the restive part where the so-called Ambazonia fighters continue to fight security agents from the government? Because I understand the fight has gotten into a stalemate, but innocent citizens or civilians are being caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, innocent people are being killed, and so the government thinks that they are winning because they have all the guns and planes and all they like to use. But the young fighters in the bush are very determined, and they think that they will not give up and that Mr. Biya should be prepared to kill all of them to the last person.
So how do you resolve this conflict?
Mr. Biya hasn't the will to resolve because many people have come in to intervene and bring suggestions. he will not listen to them. Yes, his prime minister came and listened and said he was going to report to Papa. Papa said, may I talk to him? Papa said, I should say that. And that's what he's saying. He hasn't, the will is not honest in what he's saying, and he's not prepared to resolve anything. To him, if the Northwest and the Southwest can all burn down to ashes, he doesn't care as long as it does not touch him in Yaoundé. And to quote him as saying once, he said, if Yaoundé breathes, Cameroon is okay. So anything can happen anywhere as long as it doesn't touch Yaoundé. It doesn't touch him. All other people can go to hell.
So what is next about a possible dialogue to help resolve this?
But he hasn't the will to come into the dialogue because he's coming. The prime minister came with making proposals for dialogue that is prepared now to dialogue, but with conditions that he's not prepared to talk about the secession, he's not prepared to talk about federation, he's not prepared to talk about the form of government. They can talk about what the teachers and the lawyers and the other people are fighting for, the marginalization of Anglophones, etc., but it's not prepared to talk about the form of government, which is what the young people are fighting for.
So, Mr. Fruindi, what's next in this ongoing Anglophone crisis? What's next?
Well, we are at a stalemate because the youth in the bushes are very adamant, and the government ministers have come up with their own fighters that pretentiously are fighting for the Anglophones, but they're the people killing the people now and beheading people and doing quite a lot of havoc. And Mr. Bia is not prepared to open up to any dialogue. And that's why the international organizations come in, and even the European Union, the British House of Parliament, and even the American parliamentarians up to the United Nations have condemned all that is happening here and call on Mr. Bia to take care, but he's not doing it. And instead of trying to see what they can do, they tell you that Cameroon is a sovereign state and they do not believe in any country coming to interfere. But they forget that Cameroon is part of a living world and problems in Cameroon affect other countries of the world.
John Fruindi is the leader of the Cameroonian Main Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from Bamenda. Located in Cape Coast, Ghana, St. Augustine's College is the first secondary school established by the Catholic Church. The school is scheduled to celebrate 90 years since it was established. Ahead of the anniversary, St. Augustine's Past Student Union, or APSU, held a fundraising gala at Camelot in Maryland, a few miles outside Washington, D.C. Organizers say the funds will be used to help improve the school's infrastructure. In part two of this interview, the patron of the school, Gabriel Charles Palmer Buckle, the Archbishop of Cape Coast, and Mrs. Alice Marie Ajiman, a former headmistress of Holy Child and a former teacher at St. Augustine, spoke about ways to raise more funds. Mrs. Ajiman, let me come to you. Augusto at 90, you are a stakeholder, you are a teacher there. People regard you, they regard you very highly. Money will be required for all these activities planned. What would you suggest to the organizing committees about what they can do to generate funds, apart from raising funds from their own year groups and all that stuff? What would you suggest? You've been there before.
Because they are professional workers, immediately, I think, they have to dip into their pockets and sacrifice something.
Right.
That is the number one. Mm-hmm. Because then it means that they will need to come together and... Let me give this example of Holy Child in Birmingham.
Right.
They will sell flowers. They will plant them, the flowers themselves, and sell to raise funds for the school. I am not sure the Ghanaian man will do same, So probably raising funds, not just dipping into their pockets, but you organize what you call a ponchike. You can get someone to do some excellent cooking, come together like last night, Certainly you can make some money. Yeah, but it all depends on your interests.
Right.
If you don't have the interest, you won't pursue it. As if we want to turn you into women.
All right. Pastor, let me come to you.
Let me immediately top it up. As she said, first and foremost, you need to sacrifice, right, Dip into their own pockets for it. number one. Number two, be creative about fundraising. And she's giving an example where the Holy Child, you know, women, they would do flowers and the rest of it because they have the ability. I'd like to look at the fact that the men also do have, and they can come up with a whole lot of creative, you know, inventions that can be sold. Now I'd move to another point. A lot of them are in very important positions in the big financial world,
right,
where they know that, for instance, big banks at the end of the year, they have some, you know, profits that have been made, and they'd like to donate them to charities. So they should be able to find out and write projects on behalf of the, you know, school in order to get, for instance, computers, to get accessories and the rest of it for the school from here. You know, I'm looking at it from that point of view. So that they can dip also into all these funds and funding agencies that have money available. Then, of course, we will go back down also to the country itself and see that those who are in Ghana, they should also be helped not only to dip into their pockets and raise money, not only to be creative about it, but also, as I have realized it's coming up, they are thinking of helping the students in building up a maintenance culture.
Right.
Respect for the property of the school and the rest of it. And that could also, you know, be a way of saving funds from being, you know, misappropriated or misused. So I'm just thinking off the cuff.
Yeah, it makes sense. Before we go, Archbishop, what are your expectations for APSU at 90 next year?
I would definitely say, first and foremost, they have already enthused me very much with what they have done, APSU has done to date. And so APSU 90 definitely has a very big responsibility to raise the stakes higher still, I know. And I'm ready to offer my own support and encouragement because I'm very new over there. But I think if there is something that I would like APSU to look at, is a question that people don't normally like to talk about. Namely, there are those who say the churches should take over the schools. The mission should take over the schools. Then there are those who are fighting against it. And I would like the Absunians to start a platform discussing it, debating it, and looking at the pros and cons and seeing what are the alternatives that are available to us. Because, one, it is not the desire of the missions to take back the schools as if they are ours and to use them only for proselytizing. No, I believe in collaboration, partnership, very, very close partnership. How I wish I could encourage that education should not be politicized. Right. Agriculture should not be politicized. Healthcare delivery in Ghana should not be politicized. There must be consensus. We must look at the future and give nothing but the best to these particular institutions. So maybe that is what I would ask APSU to start thinking of. But I'm already very happy with what they have done, the promises they have brought on board, and I think I'm ready to help them shoulder it to success.
Gabriel Charles Palmer Bako, the Archbishop of Cape Coast, and Mrs. Alice Marie Ajiman, a former headmistress of Holy Child and a former teacher at St. Augustine's College. They spoke with me from here in Washington. The International Organization for Migration reports two flights carrying an estimated 250 Ethiopian migrants departed Yemen Saturday for Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, as part of a larger ongoing repatriation operation. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency says it hopes to repatriate another 1,968 Ethiopian migrants who are being detained under horrific conditions in a sports stadium in the Yemeni port city of Aden. But the operation, which was to have begun last Saturday, got off to a late start. And this, says IOM spokeswoman Angela Wells, might pose a problem.
The operation was only cleared for 8 days. So because it was delayed, We are now waiting to see if we can continue it past that date. We will do our best to work with the authorities to find more sustainable solutions and to start another round of VHR and to help people where we can.
With the approval of the Saudi-led coalition and government of Yemen, 347 migrants have been flown home on three IOM-chartered flights this past week. Wells says women and children were among the first to be repatriated as they are seen to be the most vulnerable. At the end of April, Yemeni authorities rounded up more than 2,000 irregular migrants in Aden, most Ethiopians. They are among an estimated 150,000 migrants who have made the arduous journey to war-torn Yemen in hopes of finding work and a better life in neighboring Saudi Arabia. Wells tells VOA the migrants are being held under appalling, life-threatening conditions in Aden's Al Mansoura football stadium. She says delays in repatriating the migrants are likely to result in more suffering and more deaths.
Already eight people have died from acute watery diarrhea, and one migrant was shot by a guard. So the result of if we are not able to get everyone out that we can could be quite catastrophic. And so that's why we're really urging the authorities to work with us and help us get as many people home as possible.
In the meantime, IOM reports Yemeni authorities are continuing to round up more migrants and bring them to the sports stadium. It warns the growing number of people being detained under substandard conditions is worsening an already acute humanitarian situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Africa's population is expected to more than double by 2050, meaning there will be increasing need for more housing on the continent. The United Nations is asking urban planners to come up with innovative solutions to the problem at the United Nations Habitat Assembly, which came to a close on Friday. For VOA, Sarah Kimani met two innovators who think they may have solutions to some of the urban challenges and has this report from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Vamsi Gadam taps on a model solar roofed house, an innovation he says will help deal with the global urban housing crisis.
So all of this is the cement boards itself. And the roof that we have here is as simple as this. We have the first of its kind, a solar roof, wherein the solar components are infused with our roofing product. So it's just one single roof which generates power, and the life of the roof itself is 50 years. And the solar part of it is 25 years. So we are outlasting the life of a general solar panel, whereby a roof makes more sense for you in the long run.
Gadam was one of the nearly 3,000 delegates who attended the Habitat Assembly, a conference on how best to improve urban housing. At the meeting, the United Nations warned that without smart housing, Africa risked an urban housing crisis. Affordability is key, and Gadam says his model house, made partially with improvised cement board, a substitute for wood, would cost only $6,000 to build. Across from him, Belgian professor Dr. Michel Lutz takes us on a tour of the Triadio house. This is a triangular house with hanging gardens. Lutz says his model is a smart urban technology that tackles 12 of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, the United Nations blueprint for ending poverty and ensuring equality globally.
It's a kind of house which is in fact a food and income producing house. So the house is built on extremely durable water tanks, 18 cubic meters, who collects all the water during the rainy season and then gives enough water in order to grow the vegetables and the fruits that they need during the year.
Lutz has already signed an agreement with the Ethiopian government to bring it to the industrial phase with the hope of adapting the technology in the East African country. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria is transmitted by mosquito bites, but there are some things you can do to reduce your risk. Wear light-colored, loose-fitting clothing, including long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. Eliminate any standing water around your home, including water that collects in wood piles, taps, puddles, old buckets, water jugs, and containers that livestock drink from. And if you can get one, use an insecticide-treated bed net to cover you and your children while you sleep.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, African culture has given many gifts to American culture. Valerio Naranjo is a perfect example of an artist who integrates several different cultures in her life and work. Native American Naranjo is prize-winning master of the West African Jile, the wooden marimba-like instrument that combines the multi-toned pitches of the xylophone with the percussive power of the drum. VOA's Adam Phillips has her story.
As a Ute Native American and a Ghana-trained geomaster, Valerie Naranjo's own life crosses many borders, as does the geel itself.
The people who play it, Lobi Brifo, Lobi Mirwo, Dagara, Wala, Sisala nations, really straddle the borders between Ghana, Burkina Faso, and Cote d'Ivoire. They cross the borders freely.
Growing up in the western state of Colorado, Naranjo was steeped in sacred Native American songs, like the Sun Song she sings here. Her elders taught her that song carries a spiritual power to bring us to the center of our life condition. It's a belief she has heard echoed by indigenous peoples in West Africa, South America, Japan, and elsewhere.
And the center of our life condition includes hope, includes despair. Sound vibration has the ability to do that for us.
Naranjo comes from a long line of traditional musicians who share music with other tribes and nations. She was introduced to the marimba on a family trip to Mexico when she was about 13. It was love at first listen, and by the time she was 17, she had devoted herself to mastering it. The marimba originated in Africa, but it's now beloved by the indigenous peoples of Central and South America and appears in Western percussion ensembles. Naranjo yearned to combine the marimba with electric funk music like that. But how? Then she discovered the geel, but couldn't find out very much about it until years later.
I finally happened to the African Records Center in Central Harlem, where they directed me to a disc of Kakraba Lobi, who was a master geel player from the Ghana National Dance Company. When I put the needle to that LP, I said, "This is it. This is my music." Of course, historically, it's not my music, but this music speaks directly to me, and I have to follow this. I've been following it ever since.
In 1988, she traveled to Ghana to hear the geel in the master's homeland. At a traditional music and dance festival in the remote Upper West region, she felt right at home.
Superficially, adobe, thatched roofs, corn, the shucking of corn, some of the cloth reminded me of home. On the deeper level, the way people bond, the way they regard music, the way they regard musical instruments as sources of healing, I felt such a deep connection. And then ever since then, realizing that music is nothing more than the spokesperson of the deepest heart of a culture or of a nation of people.
A local patriarch lent her a geel, which was a great honor, and he was pleased a little later by her rendition of a traditional men's funeral song. She faced a far more daunting challenge shortly before the festival began, when the village chief asked her to perform for him and his council of male elders.
As soon as I began playing, Chief Garbeau rose from his chair and began to dance. What I didn't know is chiefs do not dance, they officiate.
When she finished playing, the elders began a raucous debate. She was told women were not supposed to play the geel in public.
And they were in a little bit of a tizzy. She's not only a woman, she is not Ghanaian. She is from the other side of the world. In the midst of their debate, Chief Garbeau rose up from his chair and threw his hands up and his purple robe flowing up and down. And he said, from now on, women will play the geel. For me, that was quite a moment. So I was the first performer as a woman in public at the Kobané Festival that occurred 2 days later.
On a return trip to Ghana in 1991, Nerano finally met Kakraba Lobi, who agreed to teach her.
It was one of my life's central journeys.
Her journey continues. In addition to playing geel for The Lion King on Broadway and the popular Saturday Night Live TV comedy program, Nerano teaches geel at New York University and is a member of NYU's Translucent Borders Project with musicians and dancers from around the world. Late this month, she'll perform a full concert of geel concertos with the Ghana Symphony Orchestra. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. In the European Champions League, Liverpool Football Club won their sixth European Cup Saturday in Madrid. That's twice as many as any other English team, with Manchester at only three. A penalty from Egypt's Mohamed Salah and a late goal from Divock Origi helped Liverpool beat Tottenham Hotspurs 2-0 to win the European Champions League. Liverpool's Mohamed Salah became the fifth African player to score in a European Cup final after Rabah Majer, Samuel Eto'o, Didier Drogba and Sadio Mane. Salah's opener for Liverpool was the second fastest goal in a Champions League final, at 1 minute 48 seconds, only behind Paolo Maldini at 50 seconds for AC Milan versus Liverpool in 2005. Meanwhile, the African Champions League final was abandoned due to a row over the video-assisted referee VAR system. Play was halted for over an hour after Wydad Casablanca refused to play when VAR was unavailable to judge a disallowed equalizer. VAR had been set up on the side of the pitch, but the players had not been told it was not working, although officials were aware. The referee then awarded the victory to three-time former champions Esperance. The Tunisian side were leading 1-0, that's 2-1 aggregate, in Saturday's final, which was played over two legs. VAR had been used in the first leg. But in the second leg, Walid Al-Khatri's header for Wydad was disallowed for an infringement. Wydad players protested to the Gambian referee, demanding VAR be used. The 60,000 spectators inside the stadium waited for an update for 95 minutes before the referee awarded the victory to the home team, who retained the title. It's the first time in the 55-year history of the elite Africa club competition that a match in the home and away final series has not been completed. Wydad could now face a 2-year ban from competing in continental club competition. Still in football, Sierra Leone Football Association president Isha Johansson has been acquitted on all counts of corruption by High Court in Freetown. The Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission, who brought the charges, are reviewing its next steps in line with the law. A statement from the Anti-Corruption Commission also confirmed that the ruling means that Johansson, along with the Sierra Leone Football Association General Secretary Christopher Kamara, can return to their posts with the association. This paves the way for the lifting of a ban from global football. The pair were accused of misappropriating $50,000 given to the Sierra Leone Football Association by CAF for covering of cost for the conduct of MRI tests on 30 players of the Sierra Leone under 17 team in 2014. Football's world governing body FIFA suspended Sierra Leone in October last year due to the third party interference in the running of the association. FIFA always maintained that it would only recognize Johansson as the Sierra Leone Football Association president. Sierra Leone's ban saw them disqualified from the qualifying campaign for this month's Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt. Finally, in boxing, Andy Ruiz Jr. produced one of the biggest shocks in the history of heavyweight boxing to take Anthony Joshua's IBF, WBO, and WBA world heavyweight titles from him. In a truly remarkable fight at New York's Madison Garden Square, Ruiz floored Joshua four times en route to a seventh-round stoppage, which stunned many and handed the Briton his first defeat as a professional. Joshua, who had 22 wins, 21 coming by way of knockout going into the fight, will now join the likes of Lennox Lewis and Mike Tyson as dominant champions to suffer losses which brought the sport to a standstill. After flooring Ruiz with a left hook in the third round, Joshua hit the canvas when a right crashed against his temple. The 29-year-old Ruiz was not even supposed to be there. He took the bout at 6 weeks' notice. But by the seventh round, when Joshua touched down under a flurry of shots again, the bout was waved off. Ruiz, who was an underdog in every sense of the word, had won 32 of his 33 fights before this fight. Ruiz, American-born but with Mexican parents, becomes Mexico's first heavyweight world champion. He joins James Buster Douglas, who humbled Tyson in 1990, and Haseem Rahman, who beat Lewis in 2001, as men to land colossal upsets. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. Flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Harmonize with Never Give Up, Juliana Kanyamozi with Zabu, and then Akon with Right Now. My daddy, I'm sorry. Swaratano kupenda uliposiki kama utanisi nikaanza kuimba Mungu si asumani nikakutana na simba akanipiga kampani japo kuna walopinga kwamba sina kipaji fitina za ndani ndani mara hamu anavimba atapendwa na nani makonde watanda himba nikajipa kimani ipo siku nitashinda mana mola ndo mpaji hey, now I make my paper and I bless my family pole walo nicheka Enzi na vaga kandambili Never, never, never Usikate tamama na Mungu anakuona Never, never, never Usikate tamama angaika kila kona Remember mama told me my boy binadamu wana wema watakuchekiaga usoni ukiwapa kisogo na kusema usifadhi chuki moyoni yalipe mabaya kwa mema jifanye ukumbuke uyaoni ndo maandiko anavyosema nilimtanguliza Mungu kwa swala mrakafa kaja mzungu Sara Thank you, my baby. You love me, you support me. I love you too. Shout out to my nigga, you're so me pango. Ya bulanti chopa, I got love for you. Nyama mkari buda na mchachambo. Mwambia tunapita, so me gonna do. Najwa maisha safari, mi baro stefikaga. Long way to go. Ila na yona fadhali, nkulala wakika na kula soka before. Debe kwa zizi alimbagara, tandika kimara na kariyako. Geto na kibatari kiangazi masika jomvua yote yako Now I make my paper And I bless my family
pole walo ni cheka. Enzi na vaga kanda mbili.
That was Akon with Right Now, and that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last Tuesday, the Foreign Minister of France told the Foreign Committee of the French Parliament that the Sahel nations of West Africa should do more for their own security and not depend on France to provide such security, because France would not be there forever. Perhaps this reprimand was misplaced in light of what happened in 2013. As may be recalled, following the meddling by NATO in Libya in the guise of the no-fly zone resolution of the Security Council, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya, was brutally killed, and the goal of regime change was achieved. But since then, Libya had descended into utter chaos, and the immediate effect of the removal of Gaddafi was the flow of arms and rebels from Libya to the south of the Sahara in the Sahel. The ECOWAS, the Economic Commission of West Africa, which had a record of peacekeeping successes, studied the situation and came forward with a concrete plan to set up a peacekeeping operation in Mali. They came to the United Nations Security Council asking for two critical things: financial support and logistics. Frankly, they were rebuffed by the Security Council, saying that they were not ready to undertake such an operation. But shortly after that rebuke by the Security Council, France surprisingly launched its own operation in Mali and tried to push back the Islamist rebels. That was the first frontal France involvement in the Sahel. And they realize now, after 6 years, that the operation was not a cakewalk. And many French losses have occurred, both financial and human, as well as in the other Sahel states, such as Mali itself, Burkina Faso, and Niger. Even the United States soldiers have been caught up in this security lapse in the Sahel. So what is the problem? The problem is that the Security Council should review its position on supporting peacekeeping in regional organization. Quite often, the international community and also in many academic papers speak gloriously of the success of the United Nations in West Africa, in Liberia, and in Sierra Leone. The truth is that the most successful element occurred before the UN arrived, because as Liberia descended into utter chaos, President Bamba Diga of Nigeria and the then creative thinking executive secretary of ECOWAS, Dr. Abbas Bundu, currently Speaker of Sierra Leone's Parliament, came out with the plan of ECOMOG. And with their meager resources, without asking the United Nations to come in, ECOMOG performed miracles. They saved Liberia. They stopped the bloodletting in Sierra Leone. The UN only came to clean up. But the world community talks only about the action of the United Nations. It is time for the Security Council to recognize that regional and sub-regional groups can provide security if given the adequate resources. I am fully aware, because of my own involvement with peacekeeping for over 40 years, that three members of the Security Council, Great Britain, United States, and France, are reluctant to strengthen regional organizations for peacekeeping, because they want to be able to have some influence in the day-to-day management of peacekeeping. But this is not going to last. And what France is experiencing now is clear. Even the United States were caught off guard when some of their troops were killed in Niger. And many of the senators said they never knew there are such many troops in the Sahel. So they must go back to the drawing board in the United Nations and work out concrete plans. Give to the regional organizations the capacity to conduct peacekeeping. It is in the Charter. Chapter 8 of the Charter provides for a relationship between the Security Council and regional organizations. And if this is done, then the French Foreign Minister would not have any opportunity to reprimand the nations of the Sahel for not doing enough for their own security. But this may be a warning sign, and hopefully the permanent members of the Security Council will listen and begin to talk seriously about regional peacekeeping. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Salu, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, you cannot roast corn with two eyes. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.